Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our first episode of Spooky Month for the Comics Collective, the weekly podcast where we read and discuss a collection of comic books or a graphic novel. I'm one of your co-hosts, Lexi.
I'm Anne.
And I'm Dallas.
And for today's episode, we will be going over and covering My Friend Dahmer by Durf. Durf Backdurf. What a lovely name.
All right, I gotta get this out of the way first. So, listener at home, I want you to type in the word Durf into Urban Dictionary to find out what my culture has done for you. So, there's this thing in Utah called Durfing, where Mormons aren't allowed to have sex before marriage. So, college-age Mormons instead just like dry hump until climax, and it's called Durfing, denim surfing.
And Durf is gonna change Durf's name now.
It is very real. I had friends ask, like, is this a real thing? It's real. There are definitely people that are down to Durf.
Yep.
So there you go. That's the worst thing you're going to hear on today's episode somehow.
That is not true, but thank you for that.
I would like to personally thank the Mormon community for their contributions to this podcast.
Please don't.
See, okay, but I'd heard of soaking. Is that a thing too?
That one, I'm not sure because I've never experienced that one.
Really? Lexi's saying it's real.
It's real, Lex?
I have peers. Yes, gross. It's real.
Yeah, see, I didn't know anyone that has done that one. I know durfing is real because, like, I know lots of people that durf. I've never met anyone that soaked, so I didn't know if that was real or not.
Yeah, that's more of like, I hate that these words are coming out of my mouth. That's more my generation, which is horrifying.
Love that. Okay. Well, we got the Utah hate out early, so we can focus on Ohio now.
Let's really dig into Ohio now.
Which was the serial killer that lived in Utah? There was one.
Ted Bundy.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, never mind.
I think yours was worse, Anne.
Yeah. Jeffrey Dahmer does come up first when you Google serial killers. Ooh. Not that I know that. I don't know that.
So, can we do like a little warning here at beginning?
I would say a disclaimer. I kind of thought one out. So,
okay.
Buckle up, kids. All right. So, I would like to present this very first off with a disclaimer saying we will be going over and discussing the known serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer. We will not be going into the depravity of his crimes. We will not be discussing anything like that because we don't give attention to that type of behavior. But I would, off the top, after this disclaimer, like to go through a list of his victims purely for getting their name out there, bringing attention to what has done, the damage that has done to the families, and spread more light on the people that were actually traumatized by these events. And I feel it needs to be said, it needs to be mentioned that there are people out there who are still hurting and have been affected by this. So I want to say that off the top. I personally will be going in this through more of a lens of like a psychological analysis. Personally, that's something I find very interesting. So that's where I'm coming from for this. So it is more intended on an actual diving into the comic itself, the graphic novel of My Friend Dahmer. And so that's where we'll leave it. And if you are not comfortable with those topics, you will not be hurting our feelings at all if you tune in next week. So thank you.
Yeah, we can get into this later, but I definitely have like a complicated relationship with the idea of true crime, because I definitely feel like a big hypocrite from how much I love From Hell. But I was like, that's so far removed from my time period. And like, there's no one alive that was affected by that. But the idea of like propping up these serial killers and making them famous through true crime feels a little icky to me. And so I definitely, it's a good, interesting book that we read. I think we're gonna have a good conversation about it, but I definitely think it's something worth interrogating the amount of celebrity that we put on to these horrific people. Agree.
Following that, I don't know if there's anything that I specifically can add, but just this everything that happened here, it's one of the things that's hard to talk about, but I feel like is still important to know about, because you know, need to know that evil like this does exist, and that this has happened before, and people like this will come again. And that's, it's not to, like, I know we're doing this for Spooky Month, but it's not like to scare anyone. It's just like, this is something I think people should be aware of. And I think this is an important story to tell about how someone got to where they were.
Agreed. Any other thoughts before we proceed?
Now we'll hand it over to our true crime correspondent, Alexis.
Thank you. Thank you. So like I said, I would like to go through and list off his victims, first of all, and kind of, I don't want to say like a moment of silence, but I would like to bring attention to these are who this happened to. And I feel, mm-hmm. I feel the need to say it. So first off, we'll start. We have Stephen Hicks, who is 18 years old. Stephen Tuomi, who is 28 years old. Jamie Dockstetter, who is 14 years old. Richard Guerrero is 25. Anthony Sears was 24. Ricky Beeks was 33. Eddie Smith was 28. Ernest Miller, 24. David Thomas, 23. Curtis Slaughter, 18. Errol Lindsay, 19. Anthony Tony Hughes, 31. Conorak Synthesomphone was 14. Matt Turner was 20. Jeremiah Weinberger was 23. Oliver Lacey was 24. And Joseph Bradhoft was 25. So once again, those are just the names of the victims, and I would just like to send as much love and thoughts to their families and everyone who still suffers from these crimes. And once again, we will not be going into said crimes.
I think that is wise. I liked that the book didn't go into that as well. I was really worried. Yeah. I was dreading reading this book all week, because I was like, I don't like that kind of stuff. I do not mm-hmm. like it. I don't participate in it. So I was really worried. And so I really liked that the book cut it off, you know, and was like, yes. We're not interested in talking about that. So frankly, like, I do not know everything that this man did. And mm-hmm. that's not an invitation for anyone to teach me. Like, I don't.
Save your headspace. You don't need that. And honestly, I have to say, I mean, we've talked about it before. I do like listening to true crime. I like that type of media. I listen to podcasts like that. But I do want to say that the actual depravity of these crimes, I don't want to say like one crime's worse than the other, but these are truly horrific. So if you do not mm-hmm. want that mind space, don't go looking for it. I know it's really all over social media right now. Just mm-hmm. don't. You don't need that in your mind. So just do yourself a favor. But that's initially why I did want to go over this book, because I knew that. I knew that it cut off before any of that mm-hmm. did occur. And I thought that we could take it from a very interesting lens of kind of viewing it. I mean, this might sound a little strange, but like I kind of view it as kind of a coming of age story gone horribly wrong. And everybody mm-hmm. should have been seeing the signs of said horribly mm-hmm. wrong occurring. So I feel like that's very interesting to kind of look into. What are our initial thoughts, everybody?
I would say before we give initial, do you want me to go ahead and give a short summary of the story just for anyone at home who hasn't read the book and doesn't know anything about what My Friend Dahmer is? Okay. Great. Awesome. So for everyone listening at home, My Friend Dahmer is a story told by someone who actually went to school with Jeffrey Dahmer when they were growing up in Bath County, Ohio. And the story takes place over their entire high school and part of their middle school careers. And it's basically just talking from his perspective, from what he saw, and also from interviews that happened later with Dahmer and from his family members and from other people who knew him, just piecing together all the little bits and events that happened in his life that led him down the path that he eventually took. And we see as he's growing up, as you put really, really well, just this dark, twisted coming of age story, all the moments that led him to where he was. And it's a lot of moments of the darkness that would come up later, poking its head up, and final moments of mercy and just all the things that people should have caught on to. I think one of my favorite lines in the book was when he asked, where the hell were the adults? And it's hard to describe because this book doesn't follow any sort of really specific structure. It's just a series of vignettes basically over these 4 to 6 years. And it's chilling in a lot of places. It's a very isolating book, and I think it captures a lot of what was going on in his life perfectly in that way. And it's just, yeah, if you are interested in what led someone to do something like this, this is probably one of the best examples I've ever seen. And it was a book I read a few years ago, and getting to revisit it, it's just as chilling now as it was to me back then.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I do also kind of want to, oh damn, I lost my train of thought. I have so many thoughts going around in my mind that I'm like, where do I want to start first? Because I did a lot of psychological research, because that's what entices me, everyone. I have to put that disclaimer out for myself. I'm not a psychopath. I know what a psychopath means. I Googled that. But I'm very curious from a psychological standpoint of what drives people to do what they do. And in my research, I found something referred to as the McDonald triad. Are either of you familiar with what that is?
No.
No.
All right. So let me show you. So picture a triangle. Of course, three sides. There are, in psychology, it's a theory, more of. They can't really put any grounding in it, but it's just very interesting. And they've been able to do it with almost all major violent crime people, all those who have committed violent crimes. And it's very interesting because there are three major standouts in behavior that they have noticed in these people. The first is, and we see very prominently in this, is animal torture or killing. If they show any signs of that as a child, this is all before the age of 12. So the animals, setting fires is another one that should cause alarm for fun, basically, not accidental, of course. And then also bedwetting. And they've said if you see at least two of these behaviors in your child from the age of like 5 to 15-ish is when you should be worried. And it's very interesting to see the psychological view of these people that almost every single one of like the major individuals that we know of today from media have at least two of those, which is very interesting to me, at least.
I feel a little attacked as someone who wet the bed a little longer than I should have. I don't know, like, the place for levity in this episode. I'm going to walk the line here, but I definitely, I'd like to put it out there. I may have peed the bed too long, but I'm not a serial killer.
Hey, you did not torture cats or set fires, as far as I know. So you're safe.
I did not do any of those things. I am very fond of my stupid little cat.
Yeah, your dragon cat. But Dallas, I'm curious what your thoughts. I know you mentioned a few things throughout our texts, but would you like to share any of your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this book is interesting because, like, I don't have much of a stomach for true crime stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought this book really had, like, a sympathetic view towards Jeffrey Dahmer that I don't know that I necessarily agreed with. I think one of the theses of the book was, like, if anyone had seen what was going on with Jeffrey, we could have gotten him help and could have gotten him out of there. And I do think that there should have been more outreach. I think that Jeffrey Dahmer was a product of how much America failed its youth in that era of the 70s. But I also think there are people that had much harder lives than Jeffrey Dahmer that didn't become like Jeffrey Dahmer. And so I think this book presents an interesting opportunity to talk about the failings that we have towards people and how we can help people back towards a good path. But I also think that it's worth critiquing and looking at the fact that these situations don't have to create this kind of person either. And I thought it was very interesting to have this book written by someone who knew Jeffrey Dahmer and someone who was a member of the Jeffrey Dahmer fan club in high school. I thought that was I think that's a weight I would carry on my shoulders for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. That I was like, oh, I knew this guy was off and I didn't like him, but I kind of liked that he was weird. And he was like, I'm not going to lie, there are weird people in my life right now that I like because they're weird. You know, like I work with this guy. He's not weird in this way, but like he's a goofy dude. And so I like laughing with him and a little bit at him that he's very goofy. And I just feel like you'd have to carry this with you for the rest of your life, you know? Mm-hmm. And so channeling that into your cartooning and creation of graphic novel about the subject is a really interesting choice to work through some of those emotions.
Yeah, I think one of the things that this book does really well is it really sells the idea that it wasn't just one thing. It was this perfect storm of different aspects of Jeffrey Dahmer's life. Because it wasn't just the fact that he had these really awful repressed thoughts that he couldn't talk about. It wasn't just that he was an outcast at school that had no friends, that only were there when they wanted to laugh at him, basically. It wasn't just because of, you know, the situation with his parents. It's offering it felt like it was offering the hypothesis there was all these things mixed together that eventually pushed him over the edge. Whether or not you believe that, I think that's something up for debate, but I think the book does it very well in at least pitching that to you. I like that it showed all these different aspects, and the research that went into this book especially must have been so time consuming. I've been with this book for a week. I've been thinking about this man for a week, and it definitely had an emotional toll. I was thinking about it last night because I finished the book last night and I slept in until like 11 this morning. I just like, I did not want to move because I did a lot of Googling last night that I, like Lexi said, if you don't want to know what happened, don't go down that rabbit hole.
I'm very happy to not know.
Yeah. It will sit with you and it's going to sit with me for a while. So it's hard to imagine having to put together something like this and having to live in that headspace for as long as he did.
I think one of the most interesting aspects to me was like, I literally knew nothing about Jeffrey Dahmer before this other than mm-hmm. name recognition, but the idea that he couldn't talk about these sexual drives that he had because necrophilia is like, I don't think anyone would take that super well when we talk about, but the fact that like, he was gay as well mm-hmm. in the mid-1970s really made that so like there was no way to talk about like part of this. There's nothing wrong with being gay. Like this other part we should investigate and like root out and mm-hmm. take away. But the fact that he couldn't talk about anything with anybody, I felt like was a really interesting aspect of why, kind of like Anne said, like one of the pieces of the puzzle that created this monster.
Yeah, and to kind of piggyback on that comment a little bit, I will say that he would later use that to his advantage, which is even more disgusting because of the social climate that he lived in during that time. And it would allow him to keep doing what he was doing, which was horrible. But I feel like the main theme for me, at least, reading through this and through my research the past 2-3 weeks, because I got a little excited, I will say it just kept coming back to me is how important recognizing and getting help for mental health. I just, for someone who personally, I'll be the first to say that I love therapy. I love what it's done for me. I love what it's done for people I have in my life. And it makes me so sad that almost every single person in this book, in this story, in this life needed mental help in one way or another. And I can't just help but imagine what would have been so different if people had been able to get the help that they needed at the time they needed it. And that can be said for his parents, himself, even his friends, I would say also in the beginning, the middle, and the end of the story. And one of the things I do want to talk about off the top is specifically through my research, I've found that his mom, something that really, really weighed on my soul a lot, is that his mom gets very torn up in the media and dragged through the mud, which is so sad. It's so sad to me, so heartbreaking. And I was so curious because, I mean, of course, I watched the movie as well, my friend Dahmer, and it just paints her in this such a erratic light. And so I was curious. I was like, I want to know what if there has ever been anything with his mom. Like, I was curious. And the only thing that I could actually find that she was ever, quote unquote, diagnosed with was postpartum depression. And then everyone else just kept adding more and more and more things to her plate and labeling her and trying to band-aid fix with medications, et cetera, et cetera. And I just feel like it's so sad for me to see how little mental health was regarded back then. And I feel like it could have saved so many people, even outside of this story. So many, this time frame in life could have saved so much grief for later generations. Because I mean, I know that now we have that benefit, and I just feel like it needs to have attention.
I mean, if we're being honest as well, something that was really shocking and eye-opening to me getting married was seeing how little regard the medical world has for women in general, where that's like, there was a funny TikTok that it was funny, but it was also like frustratingly true, where like a boy goes into the doctor, he's like, oh, I've got a headache. They're like, oh, we've got Advil. And a girl goes into the doctor and he's like, oh, I've got a headache. Like, well, if you were a boy, we'd give you Advil. But because you're a girl, have you tried birth control? And it's frustrating being married to my wife and her being like, oh, I don't feel well, but I don't want to be put on birth control, so I don't have any way to fix it, you know? And so it's just really frustrating hearing that this woman who so clearly was, I mean, the book to me really painted her in a sympathetic light. Like I felt very sad and sorry for her. And it's just so sad that I don't even know if she would have the resources she needed today. Like if she was going through that, it's frustrating to say that 50 years later, I don't know that our medical field is that much kinder towards a woman who is going through those things. And that feels really frustrating.
Yeah. And to go off that, it's talking about mental health, just worried about mental health in our school systems. Cause I know just thinking back to what mine was, it's like, I didn't know anyone who talked to a counselor at school, and anyone who did would have been labeled like, oh, you're going to talk to the counselor. What's wrong with you? And all that stigma be put on them. So I know that the atmosphere around mental health, although it has gotten better among like a lot of young adults, I feel is still pretty fairly stigmatized. And I know there was a vote not too long ago in the Senate where it was pretty split down the middle whether or not they wanted to fund mental health services in schools. So it's still a long way to go before a lot of these resources that we know we need actually get out there. And that was one of the more terrifying parts about reading this book for me. But there's so much in this book that just weighs heavily on you. I think, you know, it's something that put me off a little bit at first. I wanted to, if we can switch gears just a little bit to talking about the way this book was executed. Something put me off a little bit at first was the art, because compared to a lot of other books, especially that we've read on the show before, this is a very, very unique art style. It's very caricature-like in style. It's very cartoony, but it's done in a way where you still feel a lot of the darkness in the scenes where it matters, you know? It's, when I say haunting, it's hard because there's not a lot of comics that have images that will stay with me. But in this book, one of the first things I remember is just that one page after Jeffrey Dahmer has those people come to his shed and he throws that vial of acid that's dissolving raccoon on the ground and they run away and he's just standing in the distance on that fork road. And it's I haven't forgotten it. In the, like, 5 years since I first read this book, I've never forgotten that image. And it's, I want to, it's hard, I want to say it's masterful. It's a really masterful way to tell this story. And, you know, I'm going to be struggling with this the whole time, trying to find ways to like, praise this book without sounding like I'm talking about, like, the person at all. But it's a really well done story. What did you all think about the way the story was executed?
I thought the cartooning was brilliant as well. I think I've always been drawn much more to what I've come to call like the drawn and quarterly approach, mm-hmm. where it's a little bit more influenced by the cartoons of like the New Yorker or newspaper cartooning that translates into comics than like the superhero pipeline. And so I think the artwork of this story absolutely fits the tone of the story, where, like you said, Anne, there are multiple pages in this book that I can immediately draw to mind because of how the iconography that was created by Beck Durf. And I thought something that really stood out to me was talking about how Jeffrey Dahmer had like this slate-like face. And just seeing that in the cartooning, that everyone else would emote quite a bit. But unless Dahmer was doing his routine where he mocked his mom and that salesman, then he was pretty stone-faced all the time. And just the way he walked, the way he moved, I think, based on what the book told me about this man, I think that the cartooning captured that really, really well. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the cool things that I was thinking about just this morning is the fact that it's narrated by Beck Durf, but the only character who makes connection from the comic to the reader is Jeffrey Dahmer. He's the only character who multiple times is staring off panel at you. And I think that that does a lot to add to just the uneasiness of the story and making you feel the same way that they described feeling when they were around Dahmer. Just where it's like they knew something was off. It feels off. Like you feel like you were, it's like I'm having a moment with the character on the page and it's making me want to turn the page faster.
Absolutely. I felt I did not want to linger on any of these pages. I read this book very fast and not in a, ooh, show me what's next way, but just in a, like, I don't want to be on that page anymore. I don't want to be on that page anymore. I don't want to be on that page anymore. And I think something else I want to point out about Beck Durf is how well, and you called it like caricature, I mean, just how well he cartoons individuals. Something that I notice pretty quickly in superhero comics is that once everyone takes their masks off, there are certain artists that you cannot tell who anyone is anymore because they draw about three people. And that was not ever a problem in this book. Every single character that came onto the page, I knew exactly who they were before they even opened their mouth. And I find myself in a similar place to you, Anne, where I don't know how to talk about how well this book worked as a comic book without feeling a little bit weird because of the subject matter that is in the book.
I feel like for me, and of course, I don't want to take anything away from that, how you feel like you don't want to praise this in any way. But I feel like for me, I kept going back to the fact that this is kind of for, like, I just kept feeling that this was his way of coping, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I feel like I could feel that through the pages. This man truly has to sit with this the rest of his life. Because, I mean, of course, everyone always loves to point the finger at when things go wrong. Mm-hmm. And more oftentimes than not, people are prone to blaming themselves for one way or another. And I just kept feeling like he himself was carrying guilt and was carrying guilt. And I feel like through writing this, I mean, of course, I don't know. I've never met him. But I feel like this probably was a helpful way to release. And I know a lot of people in this story and in this life did the same thing. I know a lot of people wrote books. I know a lot of people shared through emotional writing. And as someone who, I mean, of course, I'm not a writer, but like I do like to write my thoughts down and help me process. I feel like it's a helpful way to process. And I really felt like I could feel that through these pages. Because, I mean, just also one of the most chilling things for me to see on page was when I think it was either a friend from high school or somebody he knew from high school. I was like, did you see who's on the news? And he immediately was like, oh, is it so-and-so? And they're like, no. And he goes, oh, it's Jeffrey Dahmer. That's who it is. And they're like, yes. And I just feel like that's the one panel that really, I feel like, punched me in the throat. Because, I mean, everybody has experiences where someone's a little kookier than others, you know, growing up. I mean, especially when you're in middle school, everyone's so mean to each other. I mean, we have a younger sister who's in middle school, and just some of the things that she says sometimes, I'm like, oh, wow, people are really mean to everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, no one is safe in middle school. But just to see how it evolved through high school and then later years, there really is only so much that someone can do. And to hold oneself accountable for another person's actions is so unfair. And I feel like I hope that the writer was able to get some relief from writing this. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it was done in a way and in a lens that – to me, didn't feel horrible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, is that absolutely. A good way to put that? I think that was. It's. I haven't thought about it as something that he could have been doing as something like therapeutic, and I hope that it did help. Mm-hmm. Because I got to if someone I knew in high school went on to do half the things that Jeffrey Dahmer did, even if I didn't know them, there'd be a part of me that would feel guilty about not noticing.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I should have been nicer to them. I should have done something. I should have invited them to sit by me.
Yeah,
I should
hindsight bias. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. The guilt. I can't even imagine the guilt that anybody feels associated. Mm-hmm. Which I just feel so – it's just so unfair. It's so unfair to those involved, to everybody except for –
I feel like, yeah, I feel like I could feel some of that guilt in this, where he's just like, it's the woulda, coulda, shoulda. It's like, even if you had tried something differently, there's no guarantee it would have changed. And one of the things I appreciate is, we talked about this a little bit, is just the honesty in the story. We talked about it a little bit when we were talking about Tilly Walden's biography. Just, it takes something to admit some of the stupid things that people did when they were teenagers, and I like that he didn't hold back from saying some of the things that he did. He was completely genuine in the story, and that's something that I really respected.
I think one of the most chilling moments is when he talked about how in the school talent show he had like an Adolf Hitler routine that really killed, mm-hmm. like everyone laughed really hard, and I was like, oh yeah, like I probably wouldn't put that in my book even if I'd done that. And you could tell he was like, yeah, I shouldn't have done that. He's like,
everyone
laughed at it. But like that image of Adolf Hitler standing next to Jeffrey Dahmer, just like talking over the water fountain. I think the willingness of Beckdurf to be so honest about what it was like growing up in a small town in Ohio in the mid 70s made it apparent that I think sometimes people excuse horrific things like, oh, it was a different time, you know? And like, you could see it was a different time, and also Jeffrey Dahmer was an evil person. Mm-hmm. You know, like this cartoonist is like, yeah, I'm not that way anymore. Like the world's changed a lot. But also like we knew something was going on. Like I don't know anyone who actually believes like, oh, it was a different time that didn't know better. With a lot of the mm-hmm. things that get excused by it was a different time. So I appreciate this book's honesty.
Yeah. I just keep going back to the fact that like there are so many people in the world, that have horrible, horrible things done to them as children, as adults, just in their life. They have horrible circumstances, horrible decks of cards dealt to them every day. And I just keep going back to the conscious choice. Everybody has a conscious choice that they can make every day. And I feel like that's the bottom line for me in having absolutely no sympathy for the things that occurred mm-hmm. and his childhood. Like, I mean, I'll be the first to say that is horrible. That is horrible, the things that happened to him. But they are not an excuse for mm-hmm. the things that occurred. And agreed. I feel like that's something that people have been romanticizing, especially recently, in the wake of the new Netflix documentary that was released. And that show very much romanticizes what happened in a way. And I've mm-hmm. seen a lot of uproar and rage over some of the depictions in that show.
Yeah.
And it makes me sick.
See, that was one of the things that I was thinking about a lot this week, too. And it's hearing, I knew a Dahmer show was coming to Netflix. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that it wasn't a documentary, but it was a dramatization.
Yeah.
And I think that's what sets a lot of things that happen in something like this apart from something like that. Yeah. I feel like to dramatize something so personal and horrific and severe so soon after it happened.
There are still people living that witnessed right. it, that were alive.
And there's like, I get documentaries just explaining what happened. Documentaries are like, this is what happened. This is why it happened. This is how it happened. Those I understand. A dramatization is put on for entertainment.
Exactly.
And I feel like this book isn't put on for entertainment, if that makes sense.
No, I would 100% agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't call this book in bad taste. Like I read it and I was like, okay, that makes sense. And there were some interesting moments in this book. The one that really stood out to me was the scene, I was just flipping through the book
again. Right.
But when he goes to take that dog for the first time
yes.
out to his place and he lets it go and says it's the last time he would show mercy. And then that last image of him looking at the skull sitting there in his little slaughter ground is chilling. Mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting to see how well the book portrays that this wasn't like a crime of passion, if that makes sense. Like there were a lot of moments where the first time he went out with the baseball bat for that jogger and then abandoned that pursuit and decided not to. The dog decided not to. Like you can see throughout this story, this person like skating up against the darkness. And then I think the way the book ends with the stopped car by the hitchhiker and mm-hmm. the story has been effective enough that I just know that this person is a serial killer. I don't know the history, but I know just from the way this cartooning is done and the way the story is being told, this is the first victim. You know, like yeah. the story was effective enough to tell me like this is when he finally made the decision to go and do these things that he's been brushing up against throughout this whole story.
Mm-hmm. I did a little bit in my research find something that can kind of piggyback off of what you said a second ago with how this was not a crime of passion. This was cold-hearted violence. And a lot of words I've heard thrown around with this case and this individual are sociopath and psychopath. And I feel like a lot of people don't know the definitions of those and the difference between that. And I have them and I would kind of like to read them because they're very interesting to me, at least. So I will say off the bat that he has been diagnosed a psychopath. He has psychopathic or psychotic disorder. That is the correct name for it. So he is actually a diagnosed psychopath that was given to him when he was psychoanalyzed for his trials. So I'm not throwing around misinformation when I say that. But a lot of people like to use the word sociopath also. So I'll start with the definition of sociopath. That is a person with a personality disorder manifesting itself in extreme antisocial attitudes and behavior and a lack of conscience. So that's someone who basically has no mental backing in deciding what's right or wrong. They cannot make that distinction. They have no fine line of where they know when to quit. But a psychopath is a person suffering from a chronic mental disorder with abnormal or violent social behavior. And I feel like that manifests itself very young in this story and just the things that he would say to other classmates and peers. Also, he was always very violent. He would always do outlandish, crazy, violent things to get attention. And that's just how he was able to liken himself socially with people. And also, I would like to kind of read a little blurb of the direct differences from that I was able to find. So sociopaths often blame others and have excuses for their behavior. Some experts see sociopaths as hot-headed. They act without thinking how others will be affected. Psychopaths are more cold-hearted and calculating. They're careful to plot their moves and use aggression in a planned out way to get what they want. And so when you said that he has no passion in him, you are correct. Like, there was no thoughts given for anything that happened. And you even see that later in life when he is finally arrested. He goes in there like, yeah, this is what happened. And it's just so bone chilling to think that somebody's capable of doing that in this way. And I want another disclaimer. Not all people who are diagnosed with this disorder are violent. I want that so clear. Not all people that are diagnosed with this type of disorder or these type of disorders choose to do this. I want that to be very, very clear. This is an individual who made these decisions.
So, Lex, you've obviously done a lot of research. What are some of the things that you feel like you learned researching this book? And then did you learn anything new from this book that you didn't know just beforehand? And it's like, I want to hear what you learned.
Well, for me personally, I did want to look at this through a psychological lens. I know I did mention that. So I was curious about what actual diagnoses he received after being arrested and put on trial, because he did receive a full psych analysis before. And I was curious about that, what he was actually diagnosed with, because a lot of people love to throw around words that they don't know what they mean. That's one thing I found in the true crime quote unquote community. We love these big words. We love to talk about them, but nobody actually knows what they mean. Nobody even knows what said words are either. Nobody knows what those disorders entail for a lot of people. And it's different for everybody too, which I also found very interesting. Borderline personality disorder was one of the ones that he was diagnosed with. But they, in the notes that I read, said that that one also was up to personal discretion, whatever that means. I'm not sure if they were just unsure of that. But I also have the definition of that as well, in case anyone's interested. It's a personality disorder characterized by severe mood swings, impulsive behavior, and difficulty forming stable personal relationships. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, so he had three major ones. He had the psychotic disorder, borderline personality disorder, and then schizotopal personality disorder, which means paranoia and social anxiety, and by beliefs, behaviors, and ways of speaking that are considered quote-unquote odd or eccentric. So we see that a lot with how he chose to socialize with peers growing up, with his eccentric behavior of mimicking his mom and also the salesman that would come to their house. That's how he likens people giving him attention, which is very interesting to me.
That is, it's very, very interesting. I'm at a loss for words.
I hope I don't sound like crazy when I want to like psychoanalyze people like this, but I just feel like there is so much depth that could go into it. And there's a lot of things that I've learned just from taking psychology classes in high school that kind of popped up and resurfaced while doing research for this. Like another one was a story that his dad shared in his book of a time where Jeff was 4 years old, And he had to receive a double hernia surgery and was hospitalized for almost, I want to say close to a month. Like, it was a really, really long time for how old he was. And his mom could not be there with him. She was not capable of doing that for him. And also his dad worked full time as a chemist. So he was alone for that entire span of being in the hospital. And his dad likes to point a finger to that being one of the reasons why he is unable to emotionally connect with people. Because when you're a child, you go through these different levels of emotional attachment to your parents, your peers, individuals in your life. Mm-hmm. And he says that that's one of the reasons, his dad claims that that's one of the reasons why he was unable to connect with people in life and why he was able to completely disassociate any feelings with people and having any affection towards anyone, which I find very interesting. And I will admit this has no standing. This is just a theory by his father as to maybe a reason why, but this has not been scientifically proved. But I found it very interesting nonetheless.
Okay. That was going to be my next follow-up. I was going to say, yeah, do you think there's any weight to that, or you think that's just him trying to blame his wife again?
I would say yes. He has a lot. He also has a lot to unpack in therapy. The end.
Yeah. I'm going back to other scenes that really interest me in the book. It's just thinking about his socialization. There's a scene in the book where they take a trip to Washington, D.C. And in that scene, Jeff is hanging out with these two other people, and he somehow picks up the phone. He goes up to a payphone and manages to get them into the vice president's office. And
that's so crazy.
It's so crazy that there's like the vice president and then Jeffrey Dahmer standing like 10 feet away. And I think the line in the book that he mentions is someone with the
chutzpah was the word.
The chutzpah is what, okay. Someone with the chutzpah to do this turned out the way he did. And then he said, what a waste.
That really
hit me. Yes, that one hit me really hard. That line hit me what really a waste. Hard.
That and then when Jeff is sitting outside of the window to the classroom drinking and you can see the class going behind, I feel like those two images rhymed in my head and keep coming back to me. Like, I don't like, I feel like they could have saved this kid.
Yeah. He was sure failed by the system. Yep. I mean, even forget your parents. Where were the teachers or the staff? They were there. They apprehended him.
Where were the damn adults? Yeah.
Where were the adults? I felt like that was a line that Beckdorf needed more than the reader did. You know, because like you could feel in the sentence before that, like how, like we knew he was weird. Like in the Comixology version of this, there's a bunch of aftermatter, right? And there's a part where, like Alexis said, Beckdorf gets called and the second person he guessed who could have done this was Jeffrey Dahmer. And like you can tell as he's writing this, I think he's a little bit like, why didn't I do anything? And I feel kind of, we've talked about like this book almost as like excising a demon. Like, okay, well, I was also 17. Like, where were the grownups? What?
Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about the fact that it felt like this book has a very sympathetic ear towards Dahmer. I read it more as this book has like I'm trying to find the right way to say it. It feels like it's remorseful of the system. Like it's
I
feel like that's like the main thing. Yeah, go for it.
No, I was just gonna say I feel like he's really like, what the fuck was going on? Like really honestly truly, like, because he also was a child. It is not his responsibility to take anything away from what happened. He was not the one who should have been noticing, and it's heartbreaking that they are the kids that were noticing and nothing was done about it. Because I feel like it could have been ended. And another thing that also keeps coming back to mind is later down the road, years and years as an adult, he does do jail time for a separate crime.
Yep.
And his dad writes a letter to the judge pleading to get him psychiatric help, pleading him to. He says, please get my son help. He is sick. He is mentally sick. And nothing was done about it. Not a single thing. And he was out XYZ months later.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, talking about the failures of our school system in managing mental health, also talk about the failures of our prison industrial complex and actually fixing people who get caught in that web, where they just get thrown in and then forgotten about. And that's exactly what happened to Dahmer in that situation. I think that's what interests me. Yeah. I think you're really interested in like the psychology of like what went on in Dahmer's head. I feel like the most interesting thing to me is just every single way that our society was designed specifically to fail this, like to fail people and to let people fall through these cracks. And the fact that they're so visible and no one talks about it.
Well, I think something that comes up a lot, I mean, off mic, we were talking about how like Ted Bundy existed in Utah, Jeffrey Dahmer exists in Ohio. I think the attitudes of these red states really does affect the people that live there. Mm-hmm. I feel like you look like, and you said the prison industrial complex, you look at the statistics for the amount of incarcerated people in the world, the United States has the most incarcerated people in the world. Yep. You look, the United States is the fifth on the list of countries that kill their own people. Mm-hmm. And you have to ask yourself what, I think there's some people look at that, they're like, what a depraved group of people that live there. But like the honest truth is, how is our system set up to fail that many people? How have we created something that puts people in these places over and over and over again? And it's frustrating. It's frustrating to, I went to school 35 years after Jeffrey Dahmer, and I can't say that he would have fared much better in my high school class.
Yep.
You know, and that's sad and that's hard. It's hard to work against what is just like cultural programming, you know, like I feel like in America, we don't look at people that are struggling and say like, oh, how can I help them? We look at them. We're like, how can I make a spectacle of this person in the shopping mall because of how they act? You know what I mean? And I'm not trying to be mean to the author of this. I think he's a human being. I think he's,
he was a 17-year-old boy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where were the adults?
Yeah.
I really like that this book covered the time period that it did, mm-hmm. from the point of view that it did. I think it is so responsible and good of this author to only talk about the time period where he was there, talking about his perception, his point mm-hmm. of view, because I think where you start to get dangerous is when people that are so far removed from this make a dramatization for Netflix about the life of someone that they didn't know him. They didn't know any mm-hmm. of his victims. They just know how to get a lot of people to click play mm-hmm. on Netflix. Yep. And so I do commend the creator of this book for being so tactful in his approach.
Yeah. And you catch that really early on too, because he's talking about Dahmer's family. And he's like, Dahmer had a younger brother. He is not important to the story. I will not be touching him in the story. And you never see him again. Yeah.
I also really liked that too, because I mean, obviously I can't imagine the toll that it's taken on his completely normal younger brother that had the exact same life, you know? And mm-hmm. it's unfair to spread information about people that you don't know, that you've never experienced, you don't know their life, and it's unfair to comment on. And I feel like these dramatized shows are doing just that because they can get a paycheck because of the social media hype that these horrible individuals receive for some disgusting, twisted reason.
So before we move into sort of the questions section, Lex, are there other things you want to bring up that you learned in your process of picking this book?
Well, I mean, no, not really. I kind of went through all my notes, but I hope people don't think I'm creepy. I promise I'm psychologically sane, everyone. More or less.
Okay, now we believe you.
More or less.
You're just as sane as the rest of us.
Yeah, there you go. My CIA agent has not commented on anything in my browser history yet. So we're good.
I talk to mine once a week.
Yeah.
I feel like I can't throw stones in a glass house because my favorite book we've done on here maybe ever was about Jack the Ripper. So, mm-hmm. I mean,
About the point that you brought up earlier. It's so much easier to discuss crime that's so disconnected from everyone.
It feels mm-hmm. like fiction yeah. at a certain point. Like, you know, like I know Jack the Ripper was real, but when yeah. I was reading From Hell, I wasn't like, oh man, mm-hmm. like I can't believe yeah. this happened. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I was just listening to something the other day that was, because obviously in a lot of my research, that topic did come up of like, why are people so intrigued in things that are currently currently have happened or in only a few years past happened, where people are still alive, breathing, and have been affected by said crime. And it was very interesting. And of course, there's so many opinions, and a lot of them are correct and have fair grounding, and I don't want to disagree with any of them. But I did read an interesting article done by, I can't remember her name, which I'm going to feel terrible about. But it was a woman basically interviewing people, asking why. It was at a crime convention, mm-hmm. which they have, everyone. She was interviewing people why they find interest in this. And she interviewed 100% women. She only interviewed women. And it was very interesting because out of the 10 women that she talked to, 9 of them said that their interest in true crime stemmed and started from a place of trying to educate themselves better and how to protect themselves. And I feel like I didn't realize that is what I had been doing initially. And then now it's just become later what she said in her article was it's become an adrenaline type of situation. Like our bodies mm-hmm. react to that fear response and basically – and I mean I hate to say this word because I felt icky when I read it. But she was like – she likened it to watching horror movies. And I was like, yeah, but these are people's real lives. So that's mm-hmm. one thing that I didn't agree with. It made me feel icky to say and to think. But that is one insight into what I read that I found very interesting about specifically why women – because it is notoriously a very women-wide community of listening to. That's just something I found interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And that checks out in a lot of different ways.
I don't know what it is, but I feel like Jeffrey Dahmer is the, like, ickiest one of this for me. Like if we had done a Zodiac killer one, like that's not mm-hmm. that much far away either, but for whatever reason that one doesn't make me feel as bad as this one does. I'm not sure quite how to parse. I think it might be the severity of like I said, I don't know everything, but like I know
I think there's a level of intimacy with the Jeffrey Dahmer stuff, I feel like, because yeah. like the Zodiac Killer, there's it's the speculation, you know, mm-hmm. it's the fact that we don't know who it is. It's still, wait, is that official? Yes. I thought they took that back. Okay.
And if they took it back, I'm going to literally go home. I'm just going to go cry. I'm going to go. Okay.
There's got to be a Zodiac Killer comic book that Alexis can find.
I mean,
true.
If they're saying it's not Ted Cruz, I don't believe them. So
there you go. There's your chuckle for the episode, everybody.
One single chuckle. You're welcome. it's you know, the enigma there. This is more like we know everything that happened to this person that brought them here. Yeah. And that makes it feel so much more real.
Yeah. Because this person got off on talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. It's not some fictional boogeyman. It's an actual person. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the more frightening thought of it mm-hmm. all, is that this guy's scarier than the boogeyman.
Yeah.
Should we do questions?
Yes, absolutely. Do we have normal ones in there? I hope someone asked me what our favorite movie is.
I'll ask you what your favorite movie is. Yeah, I know. We need to go watch an episode of SpongeBob after a horror movie.
Oh, my God.
Lighten it up a bit.
By the way, Dallas, my favorite movie is Return of the Jedi.
Ah! So we talked about that off air.
My only advice is to watch more movies.
Okay, but my favorite real movie is Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Listen, and who told you to watch that movie?
I'm pretty sure it was Lexi.
Bada boom. Yes. No, it was me. Dallas Taylor, official lesbian correspondent. Hello.
I'm retconning my own history, and I am
Hell yeah. I knew you'd love that movie, and you're like, I don't know, I'm not so sure. I knew it. Bada bing, bada boom.
Anyways, I'm going to read the first question. Our first question comes from Saul. What was the moment that left you absolutely terrified as you read on? The moment that made you say, I better check and make sure all my doors and windows are locked before I keep reading?
I have to say the moment that I decided that we were going to read this book. You better buckle down.
Preemptive.
I better put myself in another room.
I'm thinking about this book. I can't remember. I can tell you exactly what moment it was from Hell, though. It was the final kill as he's sitting there dissecting that body and just talking to her. I literally looked at my door, saw it was open, turned my lights on, went, shut my door, kept reading the chapter. I'm like, absolutely not. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, you go. I already shared mine.
Dallas, you got one? Or are you still browsing?
I think I gotta agree with you, Anne. When he smashed the raccoon bottle.
Yes.
So the second page.
Yeah, page 27 is how far I got. Every time a big splash page happens in this book, I feel like it feels like a period on what was just told. Like, you get these vignettes and you get a big splash page. It's like, and now you have to sit with the emotions of what just happened.
Mm-hmm.
A really chilling one for me was the deleted cemetery scene that was in the back. The like description of what Jeffrey Dahmer wanted to do, and then like playing out like that scene really like wound me up tight. I want to say I was very glad this book did not get into what Jeffrey Dahmer did, because like I know 5% and it's 5% too much. And so it felt like this was a book that wanted to have a good conversation about what had happened, and it didn't want to just create a spectacle. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't want to make it into a slasher film.
For me, I think the scene where he was waiting for the jogger.
Ooh.
When he stopped his car for the hitchhiker, I was like, this book better be done. Like, I'm all done.
Yep.
My heart. I was like, if this isn't the end, like, I don't think I'll read the rest of this book.
Yeah.
See, I do want to say, I'm never pro, let me say that very, very heavily, I'm never pro cops, but that cop should have arrested his ass for drunk driving. Yeah. That's all cops, I'm going to say. You're cops. Not doing him a favor. You're not. He has some sketchy bags. That's all I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm. Going cops to the fucked up the Dahmer situation in so many ways.
Oh, I could have a whole damn hour episode about the fucking cops in this.
Yep. But we can't go into any of the crimes. So we will crime. Not touch
that
how
was
the
a
cops
rule
fucked
I made.
Up.
Thank you.
Just F
we
the
got
police.
You.
Appreciate it.
F the Milwaukee police.
Fuck the Milwaukee Police Department so hard.
Specifically.
Still, to this day, fuck you. If you're listening, fuck you. Do we have sponsors on this video? I'm so sad.
Should we do our... Okay, now, first off, I got to tell you a story. So, speaking of cops, I found out this last weekend that a sheriff in a small town in Utah was fired because he forgot to turn his chest cam off when he decided to masturbate to porn that he was watching on his cop laptop. So their little laptop they got in there, he turned on a dirty video and
please
decided
tell
to
me
crank
that was
it.
In Utah.
And it was in Utah. And he went to the church parking lot because they have the fastest internet. He was fired because he was in the church parking lot watching a dirty movie on his cop laptop and he left his chest cam on. So they saw it all.
Please tell me it's the town that I want to say that it is.
It was the town that you want to say that it was. crazy.
There's a joke here. I just wish I could find it.
There's some levity for you.
Thank you for that.
Can I read the last question, Lex?
Yes. Please. Please.
All right. So this is from Marie Parson. She says, hi, frequent listener, first time asker. Thanks, Marie. Are comics too expensive? How do you budget in when you all seem to read a lot?
Ooh. I'll share mine first. Marie, get yourself an older brother who buys all the shit for you.
Me and Alexis share our Comixology account.
And that's how she gets. Actually, no. I have my own DC Infinite account now.
Nice.
Because yours kept logging me out and I got frustrated. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. I will say that's a really good place to go if you like big two comics is DC Infinite and Marvel Unlimited. They're really wonderful streaming services. Marvel is definitely better than DC because you only have to wait 3 months for new books. So you can actually talk about story arcs while they're happening.
And the UI like makes more sense. Like the amount of times I've gone to DC to be like, I'd like to read. And it's like, bitch, you won't.
Every fucking time.
The search for DC still makes no sense because I will literally search just Batman Plane and I'll get like 1,000 little spinoff series before I ever get to like one of the main, before I get to like the current run, you have to swipe like 5 times.
It's like, ridiculous. I don't care about these fever dreams. Thanks. Bye.
Also, can we cut out the moment where I say I searched Batman in the DC Infinite? I have a brand to maintain.
No. Specifically Robert Pattinson Batman. Thank you.
Robert Pattinson. Lex, you would love, there was a Riddler comic that just came out that you would dig a lot. Okay. It was very good.
I didn't do the list. I don't make the list. I just read what's on it.
Go for it, Dallas.
I was just going to say, we actually make a point on the show because none of us are made of money. Pretty much everything we read can be found on Marvel Unlimited, DC Infinite, or Comixology Unlimited. Like, it is very rare.
I have only ever bought 3 books. In our entire podcast. And two of them are the first two Invincibles.
A lot of it was on Comixology. Like, that's one of the important things to me on this show is that it's not a financial burden on any of us to read. And so for you listening, you should be able to follow along with us if you have those services. I realize those services cost money as well, but I think that they are something that's pretty easy to budget in. And Marvel Unlimited and DC Infinite are great if you like big two comics, but I am consistently surprised at what Comixology Unlimited has available for me. Right. We read this today for free. I didn't have to spend any money on this book because it was part of Comixology Unlimited. I feel like 9 times out of 10, I search a series and at least the first few issues are on Comixology Unlimited for me to look at. It's an excellent service. And yes, the transition to the Amazon store was very frustrating. I've since figured it out and I don't feel quite the rage I used to feel because it took me probably a month to figure out how that store would work to get it to go. But I also, listening to an interview with Tom King, he talked about how he has literally seen a sales boost because now when people type Batman into Amazon, his comics come up. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are, while it was frustrating for comics fans, it has put comics in front of people that weren't seeing them otherwise. So it's kind of a catch-22.
I love that.
And, you know, if money is an issue, I will always, as someone who worked at one for a while, I will always champion your local libraries if you have one. Definitely get a library card because they can get you all kinds of comics. Usually you can connect to libraries all over your state if you're stateside. And you can get books that way. Also, if you get a library card, you can access Hoopla, which has a wonderful library of digital comics.
There's another one named Libby, too, that I found. That's wonderful.
I will check Libby out.
I have so many books from them.
I love it.
I will also say I understand liking physical comics. I'm a big fan of them. And I think that physical comics are becoming too expensive for what you're getting, but I also don't know how you pay all those creatives a living wage not charging that for those comics.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like, I understand there are books that I just don't read because I don't have $8 to spend on 60 pages of something. That is just not feasible for me. And yet I understand that people have to get paid. People have to live off of these comic books being sold. And so I have transitioned to just buying collected editions physically. And the websites that I use for those are instocktrades.com, cheapgraphicnovels.com, and organicpricedbooks.com. All of those are great ways to find big discounts on collected edition comic books. They don't sponsor this show. If they'd like to, they're welcome to. I use their services a lot. I'll say Organic Price Books is probably my favorite. It doesn't have quite the same discount, but the books show up faster and it seems a little more reliable. In stock trades and cheap graphic novels, you'll get a better deal, but when those books show up is anybody's guess. So I hope that helps. Comic books are expensive, but like I said, if you like our show, those three services, Marvel Unlimited, DC Infinite, and Comixology Unlimited, should be able to help you keep up with whatever we're reading.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for that.
That being said, not next week, though.
Yeah, my bad.
Wait, what is next week?
Oh, we will get to that in just a second.
Okay. Wait, I have one more question.
Yeah?
So, what's everybody's go-to silly cartoon after watching a scary movie?
My recent favorite cartoon, Gravity Falls.
Oh, shit slaps!
Watched the crap out of that last month, and I love it. It made my heart so warm. You're all going to hear more about it at the end of the year.
Ooh, I love that. And I'm gonna take this moment to pitch. Since I've been recovering, I finally caught up on the last half of season two of The Owl House, which is one of the best shows out there. It's so cute, it's so adorable, and it's got some spooky elements to it. So if you want a good Halloween show, check that out. Also, since it's fall now, you are legally required to watch Over the Garden Wall at some point.
Oh, I love that show. I remember last year you two watched it together, and I was too shy to ask to watch it with you, so I watched it by myself because I was like, I want to be included.
You're a little wiener.
It's all right.
Also, Genndy Tartakovsky's Primal is awesome. Yeah, I don't know that it's like silly, but shit slaps.
It's definitely not cute. It's visceral.
But there are some cute moments.
Yeah. Don't get attached to anyone. Don't get attached.
Pro tip for everyone's life.
I need to finish season two of that. I'm halfway through season two. I watched the bottle episode.
No, you know what y'all need to watch? Futurama. Freaking hilarious.
I believe you. The Simpsons actually always hits for me. I love The Simpsons.
Oh, I also love American Dad.
American Dad is objectively better than Family Guy.
Oh, 100%.
Correct.
Purely because of Roger.
The Simpsons stands monumentally above either of those.
Oh, of course.
Probably,
of course.
Yeah.
The Simpsons is so much funnier.
That wasn't up for debate.
Where's Rick and Morty on that scale?
In the toilet.
Valid. But I do have to say, if I could hang out with any cartoon character, it would be Francine from American Dad. Purely because she's chaotic. Thank you. Only when she's with Roger. Those two are wild.
Francine.
Oh, Francine. I want to be Francine when I grow up. Crazy.
You'll get there one day.
Hot bimbo wife. Thank you. Flattered.
All right. Should we do the end of the episode?
I mean,
absolutely.
I guess. I hope everyone still likes me. Happy October.
Starting off with a heavy one. They get lighter from here, we promise.
Kind of. Just Jesus. Okay, everyone. If you like our show and want to hear more from us throughout the week, please go follow our Twitter account at CMX Collective or our TikTok account, where Dallas's cute face is every day, at The Comics Collective. Or you can find each of us at our personal Twitter accounts at Dallas_comics, at Ann Comics, and at LexiLou_comics. I tweet sometimes. Thank you.
If you enjoyed the show and want to show your support, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening and give us a 5-star review, and we will read it off on the show.
And finally, feel free to email us with your questions or comments for the show at thecomicscollective@gmail.com. And Lexi, sorry to steal your part, but since it's my book next week, I feel like I will go ahead and go into the next part. Questions next week will be about Shiver by Junji Ito, a collection of a lot of his short stories. It's going to be very fun. Some of my favorites are in this book. We're going to have an absolutely wonderful time talking about all the chaotic nonsense that happens.
Woohoo!
The only bad story in there is the first one. So just if you get past that one, it's the rest is all star.
Beautiful love.
For all those people that are always saying we need to do more non-US comics, here you go. No. We'll do exactly one Junji Ito for you.
Yeah, and we're picking one of the most well-known creators outside the state. You know, it's fine.
Listen, it's fine. I've got some French guys in my back pocket for next year. We'll do some French.
It's a baguette.
Are we gonna do? It's always never.
You have to do
that.
That
is a very good one.
That's very good.
Okay, listen. First off, I'm very glad everyone's getting into that book. But there's a part of me that's like, I influenced the influencer. I know that everyone has made everyone read that book. But I was like, I made that funky little bitch read that book.
You know something? I made my mom read that book.
It's
and
so
she
good.
Actually read it.
It's so good. I should get the hardcover of it. But I'm trying really hard not to buy comics right now.
I get that, but it's so pretty.
I know.
It's such a pretty hardcover.
I have the digital version of it, and I'm like, if anyone out there wants to give it to me as a gift, I mean, I won't be sad, but I'm trying not to buy comics right now. It's very good, though. Also, shout out Marie. That was so cool to get a random day, an email that has a question that wasn't about the show. I was like, new favorite listener. Thanks, Marie.
New rule. Thank you, Marie. If you send in a question, you have to send in two, and one of them has to be normal. Thank you. New rule to be a fan.
Yeah, it was nice to end on a lighter question after that heavy episode. So
yeah, sorry. Sorry I ruined everyone's life. Yeah,
but thank you all for sticking with us through that. I hope you had fun, learned something.
Absolutely. We're excited to talk about Shiver with you next weekend.
Exciting. Okay, well, we will see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.